People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, pseudoscience, grifters, the wellness industry, and mental health literacy. Jonathan Stea spent 5 years braving trolls to try and debunk myths around topics like cannabis use and mental health online. Offline, the Calgary-based clinical psychologist had seen firsthand patients who'd experienced negative outcomes at the hands of the wellness industry. Those experiences informed his new book, Mind the Science: Saving Your Mental Health from the Wellness Industry.
Jonathan Stea, clinical psychologist and adjunct assistant professor at the University of Calgary and author of Mind the Science: Saving Your Mental Health from the Wellness Industry.
And you spend a lot of time on the internet, perhaps trying to save people's mental health from the wellness industry. Can you tell me just what is that like?
Thanks, Joel. Yeah, it's been a ride. I'll say that. I've been doing it for about 5 years now. You know, it started, interestingly enough, as sort of I consider it an ethical imperative. It's when you look to the Canadian Code of Ethics for Psychologists, one of our codes or principles is called responsibility to society. And in part, that means promoting and practicing evidence-based care. And part of that principle, one way in which I interpret it, is to help the public understand the nature of evidence-based care. And that also involves debunking misinformation and pseudoscientific propaganda or grift, so to speak. And so I started this kind of social media journey about 5 years ago, just really starting in the area of cannabis addiction, funny enough, because that's my research background and my day job as a clinical psychologist, helping treat people with concurrent addiction and mental disorders. And so I really started out on social media and just in more popular media, trying to debunk myths related to the nature of cannabis addiction. And so I was writing op-eds and articles and blogs and doing some interviews about that kind of stuff. But then once I got to social media, I was blown away because I saw that the misinformation space is much broader and larger than cannabis misinformation. It extends to all of addiction and mental health and just health more generally. And so I found myself kind of immersed in a science communication community, which is a wonderful community where there's lots of different people doing this kind of work. And then I think when the onset of the pandemic hit, I think the misinformation space got even worse. And we know that because the World Health Organization dubbed it an infodemic. And so I think that really motivated me even more. And so that's what I've been doing for the past 5 years. And I really learned a lot along the way. And I noticed that people would sort of message me frequently asking me things like, you know, Jonathan, is this guy a quack, or is this article legitimate, or is this treatment pseudoscience or not? And so after just kind of doing this for years, I really decided that I wanted to help people in a different way by helping people to really learn how to answer these questions for themselves, so to speak. And that was the impetus for writing my book.
There are a couple of things I really want to follow up on there. I'm curious about just the idea of trying to, I don't know if the right way to say this is change people's minds on the internet seems like something that is hard to do in almost any context. Has that been your experience?
The short answer is yes. It can be extremely difficult. That said, there's nuance to it because there's an entire misinformation research literature. I have a friend and colleague, Timothy Caulfield, at the University of Alberta. He's been researching this stuff for decades. And, you know, a lot of his work and other main researchers in this area have found that that debunking misinformation does work, certainly on a population level. So meaning if we can have science communicators out there correcting misinformation on social media, it has an effect. It can change people's minds. Now, the reason it can be so difficult, however, is that there can be, you know, people can vary with respect to how much they believe misinformation and how involved they get into it and how much they incorporate it into their identity, so to speak. So we see this, for example, in things like the anti-vaccine movement or the anti-psychiatry movement, or just in wellness spaces or alternative medicine spaces where people become very married to particular kinds of beliefs and pseudoscientific beliefs and conspiracy theories, say, and they revolve their identity around it. And so trying to change those minds on social media can be vastly more difficult. It's a very tall order to change minds in that respect. It's not an impossible feat. I think it can be done even on an individual level, but that's not really the audience of the science communicator, as they say. It's sort of the audience of the science communicator is the general public. It's not the ideologically possessed, so to speak.
And I think in any conversation like this one, it's really important that if we're throwing around terms like misinformation, etc., and we're talking about maybe saving people from the wellness industry, is a phrase I think we've used today. I think it's important that we maybe define a little bit what those are. Could you tell me maybe, like, when you say the wellness industry, what do you mean?
Yeah, well, and I should say too, like misinformation, because that's an easily misinterpreted term. That just really means kind of false information, right? And it's not necessarily deliberate, versus there's another kind of term called disinformation or propaganda, which is really the purposeful spreading of such misinformation or in false information. The wellness industry itself, it is defined. It's defined in a number of different ways. It's monetized as well. It's a $5.6 trillion industry itself. The term wellness was actually, I trace its history in my book. The term was first used in the modern sense in 1959 by a guy named Halbert Dunn, who published in the Canadian Journal of Public Health. And he really distinguished the term wellness. He used these definitions. He distinguished between good health, which he described as freedom from illness, versus this high-level wellness, which is sort of a optimization of someone in their environment. And to me, that's sort of reminiscent of the distinction between mental health and mental illness. So mental illness is sometimes it's another word for psychopathology or mental disorders. And so, sometimes we think that we're mentally healthy if we don't have psychopathology, or we don't have depression, or we don't have our anxiety. And that can be true in one sense of the word, but mental health, the definition is even broader. It's reminiscent of Halbert Dunn's original definition of wellness, which is really about thriving in an environment, having quality of life, rolling with life's punches and stressors, so to speak, living with productivity and meaning and connection and relationships. So that was sort of Halbert Dunn's original conceptualization of wellness. Since then, though, it's really blossomed to include anything and everything. Because if you ask one kind of wellness guru what they mean by wellness, you'll get a different answer from the next. And so, kind of back to the wellness industry itself, it's valued at that $5.6 trillion. That industry, it includes legitimate sources of health, so things like club memberships and exercise classes, but it also includes the alternative medicine industry, and that's kind of what I really go after and target in my book, and sort of what I've been doing a lot of my science communication work around, because the alternative medicine industry is sort of the commercial home for a lot of pseudoscientific approaches to health, which I think can be very dangerous, since that's what I take issue with.
Yeah, listening to you talk about wellness there, even I think this program, since before I've been making it, at the beginning, it has this little blurb that at the end, says it's about issues related to health and wellness. And on the surface, it seems like those all check out. That makes sense. There are a lot of ways to take care of yourself that sort of do go beyond maybe this idea of pathology. So it's really when someone is trying to profit off of something that has no scientific evidence basis, and maybe they're possibly exploiting knowingly or unknowingly someone else, that's where you draw the line.
Absolutely. That's what I take issue with. I don't like, to put it mildly, the idea that there can be a lot, and I can ground it in the mental health world. So in the mental health world, we have bona fide professions, like mental health professions, which are psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, nurses, and they all have kind of regulatory bodies. Then we also have, in the mental health world, there's a lot of people who offer mental health services, so therapy or treatments, that don't have any license or training or qualifications whatsoever. They may call themselves a wellness coach or a life coach or a wellness consultant, Or even there's more insidious terms like therapist or counselor or practitioner or mental health clinician. Those terms, depending on particular countries or jurisdictions, are what we call legally non-protected, which means anyone can just hang a shingle. My mom could do it, or your friend could do it, hang a shingle on their lawn and say, I'm a therapist or I'm a counselor, or set up an Instagram page and do that and say that they can treat your depression or anxiety. That's a very concerning thing because those people don't have a codes of ethics to abide by. They don't have what we call a legal standards of practice or a governing body that oversees their license. So when shit hits the fan, so to speak, if treatment goes awry, patients or people don't have a recourse, and that can be very dangerous. So, and that's what we see in the wellness world. I see a lot of financial exploitation and emotional exploitation by people and companies that say they can treat your mental health and kind of health more generally. But what they're offering, the approaches and the treatments have, they're either unsupported. So there's no evidence behind them. There's no science that have investigated them, or they're blatantly pseudoscientific. And what I mean by that is that they're cherry-picked ideas that just don't gel well with the scientific body of literature that we have more generally. So they're false. They're fake, and the science used to support them is fake. That's what pseudoscience means. It's kind of a fake science.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest is Jonathan Steya. He's a clinical psychologist and an adjunct assistant professor at the University of Calgary. We're talking about mental health and the wellness industry, which is the subject of Steya's book, Mind the Science. Now, you were also pretty upfront in the book as far as addressing maybe some of the reasons that people legitimately would criticize what I'll call maybe like the medical establishment or the science, the way science is done around mental health. How do you think we need to do that in kind of these public spaces, these big forums, in a way that doesn't sort of erode people's trust in the idea that science can ultimately help us?
Totally. That's so valid because, you know, big pharma, mainstream medicine, mainstream healthcare systems, they don't get a pass. In fact, there's lots of inherent problems with them. And in part, that's what drives a lot of people to seek alternative medicine and to seek wellness. And so it's incumbent upon clinicians and researchers and science to make sure that there's better transparency, non-corrupt research, little conflicts of interest, basically doing science right and in ethical ways and in competent ways and kind of getting their act together, because that can engender so much mistrust, and that can drive people away from seeking evidence-based care. At the same time, a big message in my book is that the solution to the faults of mainstream healthcare is not the wellness industry. And that's sort of the problem, because we have to acknowledge that we do have gaps in our knowledge about health conditions. We don't know everything about mental illness and how to treat it. That's a fact. And we do have gaps in our healthcare systems. There's variability in the quality of psychologists and psychiatrists, et cetera. And, you know, mainstream medicine has the potential to do harm too, and they have done harm. But the solution to that is, again, better science, better transparency, and getting our act together. It's not to exploit people financially and emotionally by offering them pseudoscientific treatments and approaches that don't work and can, in fact, be harmful. And that's what we really see in the wellness industry. And it's a bit worse than that, to be frank, because another kind of main message I try to make clear in the book is that the alternative medicine, the term that I'm using, alternative medicine, is not merely just a set of unsupported treatments or pseudoscientific treatments. So it's not just energy healing or homeopathy or past life regression therapy, which is a variety of pseudoscientific treatments. It's not just that. Alternative medicine is an entire ideology, which means it's an entire narrative. It has its own repeated themes and ideas and its own propaganda tactics to ultimately sow distrust in mainstream medicine and capitalize on that distrust to eventually and ultimately sell their products and services. And anyone can see this for their own eyes, if they just Google local alternative medicine websites, because they'll start to see the languaging, that I again try to make clear, the language of pseudoscientific grift and of these tropes that make the distrust worse in mainstream healthcare. So, for example, if someone Googles, say, how do I treat my depression or anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder with alternative medicine, it may take you to a local alternative medicine website. And then what they'll find is they'll find particular languaging. They'll see things like these tropes. They'll see things like mainstream medicine doesn't, it only masks the symptoms. It does not treat the root cause. And our treatments are more natural. And they've been used for centuries, and et cetera. And of course, those tropes are easily debunked, and they're not necessarily true. And when we, and often they're false. And when we dig deeper, we can see that. So, for example, if someone, if on those websites they're saying depression, we address the root cause of your depression. Mainstream medicine doesn't do that. But then when you dig deeper and you ask, well, what is the root cause that they're treating? They'll say something like, well, it's unblocking your energy blockages by using energy healing, or it's giving you a detox protocol or a diet plan to treat some deficiency that you didn't know you had. So all that to say, in a kind of big roundabout way, I think that yes, mainstream medicine certainly has its problems. The solution is not alternative medicine with their polarizing, divisive ideology that ultimately does more harm than good, is my argument.
It's interesting to think about, because some of, and probably this is the reason that it's an issue that you would spend so much time and energy talking about, is because an idea like, this isn't addressing the root cause of your depression is something that might equally come out of an argument where someone would say, well, where does your mental illness come from? Is it perhaps influenced by like social determinants of health of, you just don't have a living wage or a space to live in or whatever. But I guess it's when you start to peel back the layers of that onion that things become more problematic. And I would imagine people in those situations are sort of particularly vulnerable and looking for something to help them.
That's exactly right, because kind of back to the idea that we don't fully understand all mental disorders. We don't fully understand depression, and depression can look differently in one person than another. And it's sort of the job of mental health professionals to do thorough psychological, psychiatric assessments to figure out what is the what we call formulation for that person, or what is contributing to the depression in that person. And bona fide scientific disciplines like clinical psychology and psychiatry and social work, they operate from what we call a biopsychosocial model, which means we take into account biological contributions to mental illness, psychological contributions and factors, and social contributions. And we have to figure out how these things interact. And it's super complex. And that's okay, because we're trying to use science to try to unravel or better understand that complexity. What we see instead of that complexity and that nuance and that humility, so to speak, in the wellness world, we see the opposite. We see hubris. We see the idea that they do know how to treat it, and they oversimplify these things, and that they have one treatment as a panacea that can treat your depression and your cancer and your glaucoma and COVID-19, and all of that kind of stuff. And in part, that's what makes these approaches pseudoscientific. That's one of the pseudoscientific warning signs. I lay out about nine of them so that people can try to strengthen their grift detector, so to speak, so they can try to see when the claims that are being marketed to them are pseudoscientific. So one of those warning signs is that a treatment is marketed as a panacea. And then again, it's sort of sowing distrust in mainstream medicine, pretending that it does have the solution. And it's sort of that lack of humility in its presentation.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh, and I'm speaking with Jonathan Steya. He's a clinical psychologist based in Calgary. We're talking about pseudoscience and mental health literacy, which are some of the themes of Steya's new book, Mind the Science: Saving Your Mental Health from the Wellness Industry. So far, maybe we've been talking a lot about the idea of like not getting sucked in and giving someone your money for a pseudoscientific treatment. But I'm maybe wondering just on like a social level, if you're interacting with someone who maybe like works in one of these fields or something, or like is an energy healer, or even just says that really helped me through something. How do you think people can navigate through those conversations where no one's trying to sell anything and people are just sort of sharing their experiences? How do you kind of navigate those situations in a respectful way?
Yeah, great question. And obviously it happens all the time, and we have to be respectful of everyone's beliefs. I don't think that we need to be so heated and polarized and divisive. I mean, social media is an absolute cesspool. When we encounter people in the real world, so to speak, we treat humans with respect. It's sort of basic decency. The problem is that, again, my beef, so to speak, is with people that advertise their services, and they're essentially duping people and making false claims that they know how to treat someone's health conditions with no evidence to back that up. I think that can be very dangerous. At the individual level, if someone says a treatment works for them, that's fantastic. We can be kind of happy for them. But from a scientific perspective, again, that's sort of one of the hallmarks of pseudoscientific treatment or marketing, is that they will elevate anecdotal evidence. So just because a treatment worked for someone because they say it did, that's great for them. But we don't know that it works. That's why we need to more rigorously scientifically test these things with, say, randomized controlled trials, because a treatment, anecdotal evidence is not enough to say that a treatment works. We don't know that the reason that someone gets better is due to that. It could be for many different reasons. Someone just could have got better naturally, or maybe they did something else that they don't realize, and that's why the treatment worked, etc. There's lots of perils or limitations to anecdotal evidence. So it's a great starting point for research, but we need to do more. And so that's also not what we see on, say, alternative medicine websites or wellness influencers, who, you know, they'll use testimonials to kind of market their products and services. Bob says this worked, or Karen says this worked, therefore it works for everyone. And again, that's dishonest, and it's actually considered unethical for psychologists to use. Again, sort of in our ethical standards, if psychologists are using testimonials on their websites, that's considered unethical. In the wellness world, again, they don't have those codes of ethics.
And you talk about what we can do, and maybe you point out that, for example, most of us aren't really in a position to, say, influence the way social media algorithms work. Do you think the big takeaway from your book and maybe some of your work is just you as the individual need to do everything you can to sort of take care of yourself?
Absolutely. That's you nailed it. That's the big message that I'm trying to, unfortunately, make clear, because in an ideal world or a better world, it wouldn't have to fall on people to shop for mental health care as if they were purchasing an appliance, say. But my argument is that that's unfortunately the reality. The mental health world is very much a buyer beware approach, because there can be so much variability, again, in treatment providers, and just so much misinformation and pseudoscience out there, that it's really hard to navigate the noise and to know what's real and good information versus what's false and fake information. And so what I try to do with the book is, again, I'm a clinical psychologist, so I don't pretend to have the expertise to change how we can address this problem at the social level or the systemic level or the social media level. I'm just trying to bring it down to the level of the individual to arm themselves and defend themselves from all of the noise out there. And the way that I'm trying to do that is to help people become more skeptical about claims and more skeptical about marketing of mental health treatments, so that they can better protect themselves from grift and just kind of false treatments. And so the way to do that is to try to increase their science literacy skills, which is a concept I describe in the book, and mental health literacy skills. And kind of what I mentioned today, it's more than just increasing those skills. It's also learning the language of pseudoscience and alternative medicine, so that people can learn that language, so that they can recognize when it's spoken and when it's heard and they can see it for themselves. And that, I think, will help strengthen people's grift detectors, as I say.
So to strengthen people's mental health literacy, what would you suggest? How would you suggest people learn to know when something's up with their mental health and where to go for accurate information?
Yeah, it's a tough question, but because it essentially lies on trying to seek out credible sources. And again, that can be a minefield in and of itself. Well, how do we know what's credible and what's not? I tend to say that a good place to start with this stuff is mainstream organizations like the Canadian Psychological Association or the American Psychological Association, or there'll be provincial associations or state associations, depending on where people live, because a lot of these places will have fact sheets or resources where they can kind of reach out and just kind of message people and actually talk to either bona fide mental health professionals or try to find those accurate resources out there.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to this conversation today?
Not really. I think we hit all the points. I'm very grateful for you for speaking with me. And again, I just want to, I think it's important for people, especially in this day and age and in the social media age, to really try their best to empower themselves and embolden themselves to essentially take their mental health into their own hands when shopping for care for either themselves or their loved ones, because either yourself or someone that you know has likely been touched by mental illness. And, it's one of the most precious things that we have. And, we don't want to take it lightly, and we don't want people taking advantage of our mental health. So it's important. This is an important topic for many reasons. And, it can have grave consequences, unfortunately.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it with me.
Joy, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Jonathan Steya is a clinical psychologist in Calgary and author of Mind the Science, Saving Your Mental Health from the Wellness Industry.
People First Radio, People First Media, and People First Stories are community media projects of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and are produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast, podcast, and social media partners.